Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, friends, was master of mirth and inveterate storyteller Brian Brown, who created the Brown Briefly. Together we, the Brieflies, strive with dogged determination to keep Brian's creative flame alive by bringing to you every week another episode of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy. So on this fine September day, let me introduce the Brieflies. First of all, foremost in our minds, former Alaska Airlines pilot and Vachon Airport Commissioner Truman O'Brien returns to the dials, buttons, and knobs of the control panel in the Voice of Vachon's Jean Bosch broadcast studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon. Good morning, Truman.
Hey, good morning. It's getting better every time.
Absolutely. Those who are not in the studio do not know that our own globe-trotting guardian of the galaxy has zoomed in from home. Historian extraordinary, skipper of the Vachona, Bruce, your boat is still floating. Just checked it this morning.
That's good. Always and, good.
So welcome. I'm glad that that you're able to be with us today.
Good to be here, and good to meet you, Joe.
So, and referring to our own state representative, Joe Fitzgibbon, who is here with us today, really our small talk guest today, a longtime Vachon Maury Island legislative representative, Joe Fitzgibbon. Great to have you here on the show with us today, Joe.
Thanks, Karen. Great to be with you all.
Also, joining Truman, always his wingman, here in the studio, airplane co-owner, exceptionally bright Fulbright scholar, former high fashion shoe salesman, and former Washington State Assistant Attorney General Craig Bellis is here. How are you today, Craig?
I'm doing wonderful. Beautiful day.
It's fantastic here in the Jean Bosch downtown studio. Hey, I'm Kevin Jones, former competitive cyclist, former bicycle race promoter, and the sometimes too often heard voice of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group. We are still striving to create a livable planet overseen by a government that we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. Now, as you know, before we jump into talking about livable planets and representative government, we're going to check in with everybody about what special things they experienced since our show last week. Or, as an alternative, newly introduced on this show, with our listeners, your favorite thing which you believe keeps... I can't even read my own typing here. Or, as an alternative, share with our listeners your favorite thing which you believe helps to keep Vachon weird. Okay, Truman.
Well, that's a start.
I think I accomplished one of our objectives already.
You did well on that one, Kevin. Well, you know, as our regular listeners know, I've had the jinx of the appliance gods have been down on me, and I've replaced every appliance in the house, right?
Yes.
Everyone, starting with a water heater. Okay.
Okay.
Well, last week, Craig and I and our wives are out on my boat, and we turned on we didn't realize that the fresh water pump was on, and all of a sudden our bilge pump comes on.
Okay.
And it keeps cycling, and I'm thinking, are we sinking? What's happening? No, I have a leak in the fresh water system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the good news is I found it. The bad news is it's the water heater.
Oh, my.
So the appliance gods are definitely frowning on me.
So, okay, so the moral of the story is do not invite Truman over to your home.
That's right, unless you have brand new appliances. That's right. There you go.
All right. Bruce, how's your week been?
Oh, it's been great. And, a number of things keep Vachon weird for me. One thing, getting four graybeards together every Tuesday morning to sort of talk about the world. Kevin, you need to get in line.
I'm out of step here. What else is new?
But also, and I'll let Craig elaborate on this, but things like the crazy or stupid bike night. Stupid is a word that I have difficulty with sometimes, but stupid bike night. And things like the troll. And of course, all the pickup trucks that are so heavily covered with moss that you're not sure what color they originally were. And things like Sporties for breakfast and the oversized pancakes. There's lots of things that keep Vashon weird.
Fantastic. Well, Craig, your name was invoked, so you probably want to jump in and add to the list.
Exactly. Since my name was invoked, I get my 2 minutes or whatever.
Go for it.
Like we saw in the debates all the time. Yeah, I have to, I mean, to kill two birds with one stone, what did I do the last week and what keeps Vashon weird? Stupid bike night is what the founders call it, so I'll respect their choice of phraseology. And it is a bizarre thing, but it is so Vashon and so wonderful and gets bigger and bigger every year. It was as big as, I think it is, it was the biggest I've ever seen it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that was the 10th year. The first year you had like two or three bikes. You know, now this one. And you never knew when the parade ended because it went around the block three times.
Exactly.
Which I thought, wait a minute, this is deja vu all over again. So that Friday night was great. And I went to go see my my co-host of the first Thursday morning scramble, Mike, the maestro of the mouth harp, Nichols, who was playing with One More Mile at Sugar Shack that evening as well. So that was great. And just one other thing. Last week, Lynette, my wife, and I snuck out. We got one of these last-second cancellations at Claylock Lodge. We didn't go to the lodge. We went to the campground. We camped there, had a campsite. It's impossible to get a campsite now unless you make a reservation, you know, months in advance. Mm-hmm. Out there. And we were able to snatch one real quickly and spent 2 days walking miles and miles up and down the beaches. So that was a nice respite.
Uh-huh. And did you catch two dry days? I heard a little
We did. As a matter of fact, when it was raining over here or partially rainy or drizzly, it was gorgeous over there.
It's fantastic.
So as it sometimes is as we approach fall. You know?
And Craig, we have to put a plug in for your show day after tomorrow, Thursday.
That's right. Thursday morning, first Thursday morning from 9 until noon, we are celebrating the birth date of Bill Haley. Bill Haley, not Bill Haley. That's the that's Rock Around the Clock. Buddy Holly.
Oh, that Bill.
Same initials.
Yeah.
Buddy Holly, who was born on September 7th, and
really?
And his influence on American rock and roll. So we're going to take the Wayback Machine way back and play his music and many of his contemporaries.
Wow, well, who'd have known? I was born on September 7th as well.
Well, so happy birthday.
Yeah. Happy birthday.
Yeah. I share that with Buddy. That's awesome. Hmm. Joe, certainly your journey to Vashon Island is perhaps worthy of comment, but how's your week been going?
Week's been good. I wish I'd known about Stupid Bike Night. I have a stupid bike that that would have probably fit right in there, which I tried to take for a spin this weekend, but it was characteristically out of commission. So I spent most of my weekend, it's that time of year when I have more tomatoes than I know what to do with. So I made tomato sauce and I made tomato confit and I ate more tomatoes than I really wanted to, just to try to clear the deck there. And that was probably the highlight of my weekend was tomatoes.
Cool. You got your lipocine.
Yeah.
By the way, your bike, I don't know if you've seen pictures of Stupid Bike Night, but, you're going to have to probably add some pyrotechnics.
Okay, yeah.
In order to truly be, stupid or weird.
Okay, I'll add that to the docket for next year.
Next year, yeah. There you go.
Sounds like bling is the thing for a stupid bike night. All right. You mentioned tomatoes. Apples, for me, the last year, the apple trees were dormant, as far as I could tell. We didn't know if it was the bees, the weather, the whatever's going on. This year is spectacular.
Yeah.
And the apples are like, you know, it's like I'm walking through Thriftway when I walk out into my little orchard there to see how spectacular they are. The other thing that was sort of weird is that normally the apples grown in my backyard are, you know, full of extra
protein.
Protein and other, you know, superficial decorations on the outside. This year, they're spectacular. So I don't know, maybe all the apple parasites during the year of no apples, you know, they maybe went somewhere else. So, yeah, for me, it's a good apple year. So, hey, just so we all know, Today is National Lazy Moms Day and National Cheese Pizza Day. In case you want to take advantage of either one of those, moms, hope you're taking a day off and taking it easy today. Today in history, 1957, Jack Kerouac's On the Road was published, and actually did confirm that my paperback version of Jack's book is still alive and well on my bookshelf. And possible future history, September 8th of this year, meaning Friday, Digital World Acquisitions, the company expected to take the former president's social media company, Truth Social, public, will vote on whether to extend that decision date another year. Currently, Truth Social has failed to pay bills on the order of $1 million to its web hosting service company, which seems like a bad policy for a social media company, but is still apparently paying company CEO and former U.S. Congressman David Nunes an annual salary of $750,000.
Wow.
So Truman, as a former intelligence specialist, do you care to comment on the loss or gain of the intelligence of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee now that Nunes, the top Republican member of that committee, departed Congress?
Well, I think that the overall intelligence level of the committee, the IQ, you know, intelligence quotient, has probably risen since his departure.
Okay.
But I think they're going to really miss the intelligence that comes from his cow. So I think that'll be a big departure that we're going to miss.
From his cow. I did not realize that.
Oh,
cow, somebody channeling certain
channeling some
intelligence,
from his cows,
Cool. Okay. Well, we also, I think, lost Adam Schiff from the Intelligence Committee as well. So, you know, it's we got to keep track here.
Can kind of even it out then there.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. So any other comments on the week that was or maybe the week to be? Okay, let's press on then. Small talk. Our state legislative representative took a huge step forward this year when the State House elected our guest as State House Majority Leader. Thank you, Joe, for joining us today on Small Talk.
Thanks. Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be with you here today and excited to get into our conversation.
All right. Well, as you know, given your expertise with environment and climate, there's a few questions along those lines. But then several topics that we want to get your understanding of what your thoughts are. So I was really looking forward to you and Senator Wynn chairing the House and Senate Environment Committees until I heard that you were being considered for the House Majority Leader. What can you tell us about your newest role as a state legislative leader?
Sure. Yeah, it's been a great, step for me. I had a good run. I had a 9-year run as the chair of the House Environment and Energy Committee, and I felt very, very proud of the work that we did during that time, especially the last 4 years. I would say sort of 2019 to 2022 really was like our breakthrough window when it came to climate policy specifically, but also, you know, environmental policy more generally. You know, that was the time in which we passed, a hard legal cap on Washington's greenhouse gas limits, legislation to decarbonize the transportation sector, the electricity sector, and our buildings, which are the three largest sectors of emissions in our state, as well as legislation to protect our orcas, to phase out toxic chemicals, to move towards more electric vehicles. So I felt great about that. I felt good about it. It was a good time to sort of to pass the baton to my friend and colleague, Representative Beth Dolio from Olympia, who's the new chair of the House Environment and Energy Committee, as well as my friend and colleague Joe Wynn, who represents us in the Senate. So he took over the Senate Energy, Environment, and Telecommunications Committee, and we still talk a lot about how to keep moving forward, how to keep our environmental progress on track and speed it up where we can. My new job as House Majority Leader, I'm less, I feel like I'm a mile wide and an inch deep. The thing that made me passionate about public service in the first place, and that remains the biggest part of my time, is our fight against climate change. But now I have a toe in the water on a lot of other issues, and so I get to, help out where I can on housing policy and reproductive freedom and gun safety. And the biggest part of my work these days is the state operating budget, which is the budget that covers the transportation system and not our construction of capital projects, but nearly everything else the operating expenses for our healthcare system, our social safety net, our K-12 schools, our higher education system, our state prisons, just the general government operations of the state. That's a part of the work that I do now as House Majority Leader, is work closely with the budget team to make sure that we have a budget that meets the needs of our state. The budget we passed this year, among other things, for the first time extends state health care to undocumented adults in our state, which is one thing that we're really excited about, as well as made by far the largest increase in funding for special education in our K-12 schools that we've ever seen. So I was excited about my first year in office. I certainly missed the portfolio and the environment committee, but I don't feel like I've gone too far away. I still talk with my successor, Rep Dolio, and with my colleagues, Senator Wynn, you know, all the time about how we can make sure that we're moving forward when the legislature's in session. So it's been a great role for me. It felt like the right time to move, you know, spread my wings a little bit and to move into a new job. And I'm still learning the job for sure, but I'm glad I'm doing it.
Fantastic. By the way, it was Representative Dolio who gave me the hint that you're moving on to other things. So we can thank her for that. And of course, for her role in following in the
She's a fearless leader on the climate fight.
Absolutely. So you just mentioned several things that where Washington has made really significant progress addressing the climate crisis. And the one thing you did not mention was your work on hydrofluorocarbons, for example, which is a huge polluter for the carbon, for the climate. So this year, a lot of environmental activists suggested these policies were sufficiently comprehensive, so they were shifting their focus to ensure that sufficient funds are in place to implement the climate provisions that are now passed into law. So, Joe, what's your view? Is there still significant work to be done in the climate policy space?
I think that there will always be significant work to be done in the climate policy space. I do think that we have essentially the foundation stones of the policy response that we need as a state on climate change. I don't know that we have another sort of foundational piece of policy that we need to pass that sort of the level of effort that was required to pass, for example, the Climate Commitment Act or the Clean Energy Transformation Act or the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. I think those we still are going to need policy to speed up our work, but I think we have those foundational pieces in place. And our task now is to ensure that we can implement those laws successfully, both to make sure that, you know, that we follow through on the promise of those laws for here in Washington, but also because the fight against climate change is not done just because Washington decarbon. Even if we went to zero emissions tomorrow, our job is to show other jurisdictions, whether it's other U.S. states or other subnational governments or other national governments around the world, that this can, or even the United States government, that this can be done, and that it can be done affordably, and it can be done in ways that grows and revitalizes local economies, rather than the traditional narrative from the fossil fuel industry that it was a choice between the environment and the economy. So I think that we're making good progress with that, but that's the hard part. You know, we're over the headline grabbing part, and now we're to the part where we have to, we have revenue coming into the state from the Climate Commitment Act, and that we have to make sure that those dollars are going to the areas where they can go the furthest, where they can help people transition off of dirty fossil fuels, and also help protect people from the volatility in prices of dirty fossil fuels like gasoline, natural gas, and fossil-powered electricity. So that is what we're focused on now. It's not the same binary as it was when our work was get the law passed, you know, get it over the finish line, and then all we. So it's. You know, I don't know if it's harder. It's different, though. It feels like we're at a different phase of the fight now that we're over the hump on getting the laws passed. But the work is by no means done.
Yes. Well, and I'm looking forward to when those other states in the nation can follow our lead that you have.
And we're already seeing that. And yes. We're seeing some, you know, just this year, Oregon adopted a building performance standard very closely based on the clean buildings law that we passed in 2019.
Nice.
Colorado passed theirs last year, right? So we're starting to see some of that traction. New York is looking very closely at Washington as they develop their cap on carbon pollution. I wish it was happening faster, but we You know, and we benefit from other states' experience too. We copy from California a lot. We've copied from New York. We've copied from Oregon. We've copied from many of our peer states. So we are seeing that, you know, but the better we do here locally, the more we'll see that across the country.
Yes, fantastic. Well, hey, as you know, many Vashon Mori activists supported passage of that Clean Energy Transformation Act, which you mentioned. It does require a utility to divest from coal and fossil gas in their electricity. Many testified at hearings to encourage PSE to take the law seriously and move as quickly as possible to clean up our electricity. Now, interestingly, a report by the American Council on the Energy Efficient Economy says PSE is ranked only 40th of the nation's 53 largest energy companies in promoting energy efficiency. I'm just wondering, Joe, is it time for the legislature to focus on how our state climate legislation is being implemented and set more explicit timelines to achieve our clean energy future?
Well, we absolutely need to focus on implementation. That's there's no question that passing more headline-grabbing policies is not what we need right now. What we need is to make sure that the laws that we've already passed are successful. You know, I need to better understand what metrics that report is evaluating PSE based on so that we can understand how does policy need to shift in order to bring them up in those rankings. There, our energy efficiency part of our framework for utilities is based on Initiative 937, the renewable energy law that the voters passed in 2006. And so it closely ties utilities' energy efficiency planning requirements to the plans adopted by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, which is a federal agency that covers Washington, Oregon, Montana, and Idaho, and sets energy efficiency targets to guide our utilities, including the Bonneville Power Administration, where much of our public power comes from. And I know that there's a big push underway right now at the Northwest Power and Conservation Council to really strengthen those targets. I think that that's something that we have observed locally is that whereas Washington and the Northwest used to be, you know, a national leader in pushing forward on energy efficiency, that we're maybe not as much of a national leader as we once were. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, our power is relatively cheap, although it doesn't always feel that way. We have a relatively cheap power compared to most parts of the country. And I think that is no excuse to slow down our progress on energy efficiency. We are undertaking efforts in specific building areas of our building stock, particularly large commercial buildings and large multifamily residential buildings, to require that they become more efficient. But that utility pathway of having utility-funded energy efficiency improvements seems to be somewhere that we, you know, should push down the electric vehicle pedal a little harder. And so I want to understand that report that you mentioned and where PSE is falling short, as well as, you know, the utilities in our state that it didn't rank, Seattle City Light, Avista, Tacoma Power, you know, and where do they need to accelerate their progress as well.
Yeah, makes sense.
So along those lines, my question is about solar, and in particular, how is the state promoting or supporting the solar efforts?
Yeah. So the biggest way that we promote solar is with our net metering law, which requires that utilities essentially give a credit to their customers who have solar on their roof and are feeding electrons back into the grid. So I have solar on my roof. I live in the Highland Park neighborhood of West Seattle. I'm a Seattle City Light customer, and I'm pretty happy with our investment in solar because, you know, I don't have an electric bill. My solar panels make up more than the electricity that my house uses, even though we have a heat pump and all of our heat and cooling is now electric. So it's been a great investment for us. That said, I know that, you know, there's a hurdle that folks have to get over in order to be able to finance those panels in the first place. We've tried to expand sort of creative financing tools to make it easier for people to make that initial investment in solar. And I will say the federal government, you know, finally, at long last, with the adoption of the Inflation Reduction Act, is really finally stepping up to the plate with really significant, both in size and in their predictability, federal incentives for things like solar panels on our roofs. One of the challenges with this sector in terms of tax credits historically has been that the tax credits kind of came and went. And so you had to really tune in to, oh, are the tax credits on this year? Are they off? Are they phasing out? And thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, we're going to have a lot more predictability over those solar tax credits, as well as every other kind of renewable energy tax credit for the foreseeable future. So for folks who are thinking about investing in solar in their homes, those federal incentives are going to go a long way. But then also the state, and we are constantly looking at ways, how can we expand and strengthen that net metering law to make it even more friendly to people with solar on their roofs, or any other kind of distributed, you could have your own wind turbine, for example, who are feeding electricity back into the grid. How do we make that really work out?
Let me follow up on that for a second, Joe. You had a recent newsletter where you said that some $50 million, I think, was set aside to help incentivize Washingtonians to buy electric cars. There's a lot of interest on Vashon in electric cars. Matter of fact, for years we had a Friday morning show that used to count the number of Subarus that went by during a 10 or 15-minute period. And one day, Teslas outnumbered the Subarus that went by. How is that $50 million going to be available to residents of Washington?
Yeah, great question, Craig. So the $50 million that we've set aside for electric vehicle incentives is not yet available to customers. What we have underway right now is there's a Electric Vehicle Coordinating Council, which we set up in 2022, which is developing a state transportation electrification strategy, and really to identify what are the areas where those incentives can go the furthest. We had tried to pass the incentive in 2022 and ultimately reached kind of an impasse over how many of those incentives were going to go towards just to really low-income people, and how many were going to go towards people who could afford the electric vehicle without an incentive. And that was an area that we just couldn't find agreement on in the legislature, because there were some folks who were really strongly didn't want to see those incentives going to people who could afford their own car. There were other people who really felt strongly that the incentive should be available to everybody to make the transition to electric vehicles as fast as possible. And so what we did as a compromise is we parked the money for the incentives while we waited for this new Electric Vehicle Coordinating Council to develop this strategy. So that should be forthcoming soon. The things that we have in the meantime are we have a sales tax exemption for electric vehicles, which is for electric vehicles under $45,000 in their sticker price, or under $30,000 for a used vehicle. There's no sales tax, which is a significant, that's 10% essentially off of the purchase price, as well as the incentives that the federal government has made available now through the Inflation Reduction Act, which again are kind of limited in nature. They're really targeted at vehicles built in the United States, which limits it. Not every EV is built here. And then, in the near future, within the next year, we'll see that state pot of money that you referenced come online for, probably for most folks who are interested in buying an EV.
So can any of that money be put toward infrastructure of putting in additional charging stations and that sort of thing?
Yeah. In the meantime, we're putting a lot of resources into infrastructure, into charging stations. What most folks need when they have an electric car is they need somewhere to charge at home, and they need somewhere to charge at work. Right now, but in the modern age, not everybody has a fixed workplace. Right. So having somewhere to charge at work is no longer as straightforward as maybe it was pre-pandemic, when having a set work site was more of an expectation, as well as having somewhere to charge at home is often not really practical for renters, especially renters in an urban area where their home may not come with a parking space. So we're spending a lot of both state and federal dollars on charging stations, both the super fast chargers, which are can charge your vehicle in 20 minutes or less, as well as the level two chargers, which are slower but are much less expensive to install. And we have a bonus for the dollars that go towards those chargers for ones that are to the benefit of low-income people or in communities that have lower EV adoption rates, because that's where we really have the greatest air quality challenges, as well as the greatest needs to address income inequalities for communities where being the first adopter for electric vehicles is not historically financially practical for them. So we're spending, we know that there's this chicken and egg problem with EVs. Is do we, do we start with the infrastructure? Do we start with the vehicles? The truth is we needed to be doing both at the same time, and we are doing both at the same time.
Okay. Now, Truman, did you say that Bruce had a question?
Didn't you have?
Yeah, I do, Joe, and a little more of a philosophical question, if you will. What you're describing is sort of states as the laboratories of democracy. You know, I mean, all of these things that we're doing in Washington State and you're getting from other states and states are getting from us is great kind of stuff. And ultimately, it's affecting national policy. You know, at the same time, a number of states are becoming the laboratory for anti-democratic policies, you know, limitations of voting rights, you know, all kinds of things, you know, gerrymandering, those kind of things. How do you see that in your future as a legislative leader in Washington? How do you see balancing that? And how do you see pushing the progressive side of that and restraining, you know, the non-progressive or anti-democratic side of that?
Yeah, I mean, thank you, Bruce. And it's a great question. It's a tough question because there's, here in Washington State, you know, we cannot compel our neighbors in Idaho to do the right thing, but we can be a beacon, right? We can do the best job possible so that states around the country see that making democracy accessible, making democracy easy, making democracy inclusive and equitable are worth doing. You know, that they pay off for our whole state. So I would venture that Washington has the easiest voting laws of any state. We might be tied with some other state. We might be tied with Oregon or with Minnesota or with one or two others, but I don't think there's any state that makes voting more accessible than Washington in terms of the ease of voter registration, which is something we've worked very hard on to make registration automatic for folks who don't opt out, to make registration available right up to the day of the election. Of course, voting by mail is something that we in Oregon pioneered. We have adopted state-level voting rights acts to ensure that, in addition to the federal Voting Rights Act, that we also don't see cities like the city of Yakima was a hotspot for this, where they sort of gerrymandered their city council districts to make it harder for the Latino community in Yakima to elect city council members from that community. So I think we've really been at the cutting edge of this. Part of what we need to do is to continue to send people to the U.S. Congress who will fight for strong national voting rights laws, which, you know, we certainly have done here in this state. I also think that there's work for us to do to try to help elect, you know, I don't want to be too partisan here, but, you know, to elect people in states that are on the knife edge who will stand up for democracy. So, you know, I'll just look back to last fall, the state of Michigan, for the first time in over a generation, elected Democratic majorities to their House, their state House, and their state Senate. I think that kind of surprised a lot of people because there's been this narrative about places like Michigan and the upper Midwest sort of moving towards this Trumpist anti-democracy narrative. And I think that the voters in that state and in a lot of states actually really surprised people by going the opposite direction and saying, no, we're not here to overturn the 2020 election. We're here to stand up for democracy and to send people there who will strengthen democracy. I think that we here can support people around the country who are running for office on a pro-democracy platform as well. But, you know, our work begins at home. Our work begins by making sure that there's that the people who would do harm to our government do harm to our democracy. In fact, you know, we had a legislator in the Washington House for a number of years, Matt Shea from Spokane Valley, who was was kind of in some ways Trump before Trump in terms of the rhetoric that he expounded about violently taking control of the government. And he's no longer in the legislature. And I think that is part of our work here is to show that kind of, anti-democratic rhetoric, anti-democratic actions are things that we won't stand for. You know, there's a lot of Washingtonians that went to D.C. for January 6th, and I'm encouraged to see the federal legal system saying, you know, as a deterrent, that those are serious crimes that we're going to, you know, hold people seriously accountable for, because this is not the kind of thing that we can take lightly when people work to end our democracy.
All right. I say thanks for leaning into that progressive persuasion, which is a hallmark of Brian's introduction.
We welcome that on the Brown Briefly.
Yeah, that was an excellent discussion. I really appreciate you addressing that issue. Getting back maybe to a little more microscopic and out of the macroscopic, that newsletter that we talked about a minute ago that set aside $50 million to help Washingtonians buy electric cars, it also talked quite a bit about investments in health care, particularly behavioral health. What sorts of things do you have in mind or hope will come of that?
Yeah, okay, well, so two or maybe three at the top of the list. One is just increasing the Medicaid reimbursement rates for behavioral health providers so that behavioral health providers, you know, therapists, psychologists, others who are providing care to people who are who get their health insurance through the state, through the Medicaid program, are reimbursed at higher rates. In part, that is to incentivize more providers to accept Medicaid so that the Washingtonians who are on state health care are more able to find a provider, because we know there's long waiting lists at a lot of providers, especially the providers that take Medicaid, as well as for the providers who already take Medicaid, for them to recoup more of their costs and to help them sort of stay in that field, to help them bring more workers on board. The second part is workforce development. So we've really tried to invest in getting into behavioral health. Behavioral health is a term we generally use to include both mental health care and substance use disorder. So it's it's an umbrella term that includes both mental health care and chemical dependency. We have tried to increase pay for the people in that profession because it has historically not been a very well compensated profession. You go to school, get a master's degree, come out with a lot of debt, and then go take essentially a minimum wage job. And that is not how a society that really values that workforce ought to treat that workforce. So we have tried to increase pay as well as increase student financial aid for people going into the behavioral health workforce. And that is part of what the Medicaid rate increase is intended for, is so that providers of mental health care can also compensate their workforce better, which also improves the quality of that health care because it means less turnover, more stability in the workforce. People who are, have that experience providing that care, stay there longer, and provide a higher quality of care. And then finally, the last piece is that we've tried to grow. We need to actually grow the physical space for providing of this care. We need more places where both chemical dependency, addiction treatment can be provided, but also places where acute sort of mental health care can be provided. We know our state institutions for people with severe behavioral health conditions, Western State and Eastern State Hospital, are way past their prime. They're not very therapeutically appropriate spaces. I've had the chance to tour Western State Hospital, and it's not somewhere that I would want to be if I were ever, but I would especially not want to be there if I were in the middle of a behavioral health crisis. But that's what we've got. So we're trying to build more beds, more therapeutically appropriate beds. So when somebody is either voluntarily or involuntarily committed for evaluation and treatment through the state healthcare system, that they that there's somewhere for them to go, that they're not just stuck in a hospital bed, and then also that's a therapeutic place where they're actually getting care that helps them recover.
So specifically about Vashon, you're speaking of Medicaid, for example. We are considered an urban area because of the proximity to hospitals, and yet we are really isolated, obviously, because of the moat which mm-hmm. goes around the island. And I know that there in the past at Vashon Community Care, for example, we were able to get some additional funding because we were considered rural. Is there any chance that the island could be reclassified mm-hmm. as rural so that they can receive that higher Medicaid rate?
Yeah, that's a good question, Truman. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I will have to try to find out what's involved in identifying communities, with that rural designation.
You know, we had, while we're talking about healthcare generally, we did have a listener who saw that you were going to be in the studio today, and asked about the Washington State Advanced Healthcare mm-hmm. Directives and the fact that we have a statute on the books that says that these provisions, that these end-of-life provisions mm-hmm. that you can put in a healthcare directive don't apply if the individual has been diagnosed as pregnant, mm-hmm. Which is, I didn't even know. It never came across to my attention, and when it did, I was quite surprised. Mm-hmm. Is the legislature going to be looking at advanced directives in general and that provision in particular?
Yes. So when this issue was first raised for me and for my former now retired colleague, former representative Eileen Cody, I think in fall of 2022, we looked into it and agreed that there's no reason, certainly don't support excluding pregnant people from being able to use an advanced directive. That's a clearly a relic of a way of thinking that is no longer one that we think is okay with Washington law, that advanced directives don't apply to pregnant people. What we did at that time is reached out to the advocacy organization, End of Life Washington, that deals with the policies related to advanced directives and also deals with end of life care more generally. And what they said to us is they absolutely want to fix that provision of law. They were planning a sort of larger revamping of the advanced directive statute in 2024. But then in 2023, their focus was really on expanding the I'm trying to remember the right terminology. That the ability for people to end their life compassionately, that law has been found to not be very effective in rural areas because of the number of medical providers that that it requires to sign off on an end of life, somebody wishing to end their life because they have a terminal illness. So we did, after a number of years, finally got that law passed, which lowers barriers for folks who are looking to make a choice to end their life with the guidance of a doctor who finds that they're terminally ill. We got that law passed. Sometimes we have to, I think, follow the lead of the organizations that are working in these spaces and not, substitute our judgment as legislators for theirs entirely. We are not aware of any instance in which a pregnant person in Washington has been denied use of an advanced directive due to that provision. So I think what we're hoping for is, following the lead of the advocates in this space, we'll be looking to, in 2024, update the advanced directive statute, including to remove that provision excluding pregnant people from the ability to use it.
Okay. It does sound like so much of what goes on in the legislature, you have to be strategic in how you address these issues.
We have to triage a lot because there's always more to do than we have the time and legislative capacity to get to. And so, for example, with advanced directives being a good example, if you can do a bunch of changes that are needed to advanced directives in one bill, that's much more efficient than trying to do, three or four different bills for three or four different provisions. And so we try to sort of collate our work in ways that makes us more efficient. If this was something that we knew was causing imminent harm to people looking to use an advanced directive, I think it would significantly move it up on the to-do list. Yep.
So speaking of end of life, I know that gun safety is in mm-hmm. gun violence has been a huge issue here in the United States and in Washington State. And, you see the bumper stickers, when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns and sort of thing. What have you done and what do you see the legislature doing moving forward in gun safety?
Yeah, great question. I'll say I don't know that we've ever had the kind of productivity on gun safety in state history that we've had in the last couple of years. In 2022, we passed a ban on high-capacity magazines, which limited the number of essentially rounds a firearm can hold to 10 in guns for sale in Washington, with some limited exceptions, but essentially that you can't have a gun with 15
rounds.
Or 20 or 30 rounds. That was a hard fought bill, but we got that passed in 2022. this year, this session, you know, January through April was our session. We passed three major gun laws. One was a 10-day waiting period to buy a firearm. One was the ability for people to sue gun dealers and gun manufacturers who are found to have been marketing their guns irresponsibly. You know, there's a lot of courtroom work that needs to take place to figure out when that, you know, meets what kind of actions meet that threshold. But, you know, for, there's anecdotal stories of gun manufacturers, you know, marketing their guns with a knowledge that they could be used in crimes and maybe mark, you know, highlighting the aspects of them that makes them, for example, untraceable or able to fire a lot of rounds in a short time. That those are things that both dealer as well as gun dealers who, you know, some of whom are very responsible, you know, really do adhere to background checks and some of whom are not. And to require them to be enable them to be held accountable in a court of law. And then finally, we passed an assault weapons ban, which, you know, we had a federal assault weapons ban. We know that the, as soon as the federal assault weapons ban expired, we saw a significant increase in the number of those firearms that are able to fire a lot of rounds really rapidly, became more available. And so, you know, we have banned the sale of assault weapons in Washington State. We know that we're a, you know, we're a, have a federal system that we don't have border checks on the border with Idaho. We don't have border checks on the border with Oregon. So we're not under the illusion that these laws alone are going to keep the most dangerous firearms out of Washington State. But we do know that making them harder to get is very strongly correlated with reducing the incidence of gun violence. And that states that have stronger gun laws are very clearly shown to have lower levels of gun violence and gun deaths, both from homicides as well as from suicides as well as from accidental gun deaths. So next steps, we need to, I think one of the things that I'd really like to see us do is to require a permit to purchase a firearm, which involves a training requirement. So that's one thing that that I know is going to be proposed next session. Another thing I think is that I would welcome and that some that we know that some states have done is more oversight of gun dealers to make sure that gun dealers are following the safest practices when selling firearms, that, you know, that people that they identify as potentially risky, that they're not, you know, making it really easy for those folks to get guns. So those are the things that I think are at the top of our to-do list, but there's no question that we've gotten a lot done in the last couple of years and that we really need federal action in order to deal with the porous nature of our state borders.
Hey, Joe, I had a question about, you know, 70 years ago when the Washington Ferry System was formed, it became part of the highway system, essentially. It's just an extension of the highway system. And many people on Vashon and many other islands in Puget Sound, you know, don't feel like it's really has that priority with the state legislature. So my sense is my question to you is I see the state is investing more in new ferries and that kind of stuff. That's 4 or 5 years down the road before they come online. What can we do to ensure that we have transportation from the island to the mainland, particularly for the islands like Vashon and the San Juans that don't have bridges? And how can we ensure that it's treated like a highway? If a bridge across the Columbia River went down, it would be fixed as quickly as possible. Our bridge, quote, ferries, you know, don't seem to be getting fixed. How do you address that? And what do you see the legislature doing?
Yeah, well, I knew it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't have been a Vashon conversation without talking about the ferry system, you know, and you know, the ferry system is not thriving, and you know, I get the alerts whenever the routes go down, you know, whenever we go down to one boat on the triangle or whenever the south end boat is offline. It happens way too often. It's profoundly frustrating, and you know, I mean, I'm not an islander myself, but I, you know, I think when I see those alerts about the number of people having their day, you know, or potentially their week completely, you know, disorganized by a system that folks should be able to rely on to get on and off the island in a timely way. The biggest barriers, which I think, you know, you probably know already, and then most of your listeners probably know already, but I'll just reiterate them. We have inflexible requirements from the Coast Guard around the number of trained and certified crew that need to be on board in order for a vessel to sail. So when a vessel dips below that required number of crew, there's no flexibility to say, you know, we'll just wing it. You know, like that boat can't sail. And so that is probably the number one thing that leads to trips being canceled, which is profoundly frustrating. It happens on every route in the system, you know, including the routes, you know, to islands with no bridges. It happens to the routes, you know, to Bainbridge and places that are able to drive around. Everybody on the west side of the Sound that relies on Washington State ferries is impacted by that, is very frustrated by that. And then the other side of it is the boats themselves being very old. You know, and this one, I think, you know, it really is on the legislature, the fact that we didn't replace them sooner. The boats were, you know, largely built to have 50-year lifespans. You know, many of them are 60 years and older. We are trying to build new boats right now, although the supply chain as well as workforce constraints that everybody has seen over the course of the pandemic has meant that we've been slower. It's been both slower and more expensive to get those new production lines underway than we originally budgeted for. So the new boats are more expensive than we planned for. We've significantly increased money for recruiting, particularly recruiting crew for the ferries from communities that haven't traditionally looked to working on the water as a chosen career path. But it takes a while because they have to go through a pretty extensive certification process. What I have been told by Washington State Ferries, because I, you know, they know my number when they see it on the, you know, yeah, pop up on the caller ID.
They're still answering.
Yeah, they do still answer, but you know, it's not usually good news. That when the new class graduates from their training this fall, that's the threshold where they think there will be enough crew to be able to restore three-boat service to the Triangle route. I know, you know, that is just, even once we're restored to three-boat service, you know, on a daily basis, that does not mean that there's not going to be days when one of the boats goes down. We know that there's the problems that Issaquah has had over the last week with its propulsion system, right? This is unfortunately what goes with the territory with having these super old vessels. All I can say is that we are working on it. That doesn't mean that it's good enough. That doesn't mean that people should be happy with the quality of the service. I'll say, you know, ferries are part of the state highway system. They are also, by, you know, an order of magnitude, the most expensive part of the state ferry system. You know, most of the state ferries don't require the level of both fuel and crew that this component of the state ferry system has, which means that we kind of have this balancing act as legislators representing ferry districts, that we have to keep our colleagues who don't represent the ferries wanting to continue to support the system. And part of that means not competing with one another. You know, if legislators representing ferry districts started competing with one another, saying, you know, Vashon should be on three-boat service and Kingston Edmonds should be on one-boat service, we would lose the consensus that we kind of need to get people from everywhere else in the state to continue to see the ferry system as part of the state highway system. So we try really hard not to do that infighting, but it also means, you know, that we, you know, have to sometimes stand up for Bainbridge.
Has the legislature changed the rule about vessels needing to be constructed here in Washington?
Yes, actually, good. Great question, Truman. So, yes, we passed a law this year which allows vessels to be procured outside of the state of Washington for the first time in a couple of decades. I will say that's not an easy decision to make. You know, I also am, you know, my district includes Vashon. It also includes Harbor Island, where Vigor Shipyards is and where most of our ferries have been built. And there's a lot of good quality, you know, sheet metal electrician jobs there. And so, you know, I do feel protective of that shipyard as well. But I also recognize that we can't sustain this part of our highway system by confining ourselves to only built-in Washington construction. So the law we passed this year allows out-of-state procurement, provides bonuses in the evaluation of those contracts for shipyards that follow Washington labor standards and environmental standards. You know, but in all likelihood, we're looking at either California or Louisiana, Mississippi for future lines of vessel construction.
And the other option would be to subsidize or to promote this, the training programs. Mm-hmm. Is there any effort toward that end?
We are definitely trying to promote the training, people getting into the profession of working on the water. Right. And that is something I think folks know, that there's workforce shortages across the entire economy. So it's not like in some labor markets where, you know, people are really thirsty for those, you know, those good paying jobs. There's good paying jobs a lot of places. So it's a little harder to get people into the pipeline. But we are definitely trying to evangelize, and I'll evangelize here, and I encourage everyone to do it, about the fact that these are good jobs working on the ferry system. Those are good jobs. They have a good pension. They have good healthcare benefits. And for, you know, anybody who's, you know, got somebody in their life who's thinking about a career path and loves being on the water, it's a good job that I hope that people will encourage people in their lives to think about.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to say that my neighbor actually works for the ferry system and lives on Vashon. And I've heard from many people how hard it is to find a job and be able to live on Vashon. So maybe that's a winning combination.
There you go.
Any other questions for Joe while we're here? We're down to about the last 4 minutes.
Just one
or
quick question. Just about the Mifepristone, miscarriage abortion drug, and the limitations on sending it through the mail that's working through the courts right now. Is the legislature prepared to address that?
Yeah, so there's nothing we can do about the Postal Service. That's, they're governed by federal law. And, you know, I certainly hope that the U.S. Supreme Court sees the light of day and sees that there's no, you know, medical reason to restrict the sale of Mifepristone through the Postal Service. What we did in Washington State is we passed a law this legislative session to essentially allow the State Department of Corrections, our prison system, which is the one state agency that had a pharmacy license, to stockpile a bunch of Mifepristone and in anticipation of this potential court ruling, so that they can distribute it safely to Washingtonians. So we don't think there's any likelihood that Washingtonians will lose access to Mifepristone through pharmacies, in part because we have this stockpile through the State Department of Corrections that we passed a law to allow them to sell to other pharmacies. That said, you know, there's still some legal uncertainty that the federal courts are going to have to clear up over whether it can be acquired through mail. I know we're in a much better spot, in part because of that preventative action we took, than a lot of states, but you know, this is a tough time for reproductive rights in the country, thanks to, you know, a federal judiciary that has made some really bad decisions.
All right. Well, thanks. Thank you, everybody, for your questions. And Joe, thank you for letting us know your thoughts about all these issues. For those who have not been involved in looking at all the legislation that comes forward in any one year, which I've been doing for the last 4 or 5, it's just amazing. Hundreds of bills get introduced every session. You've got a long session, thousands, yes. Yeah. In a long session, you have 3 months, yeah, right, to address all of those. Mm-hmm. In a short session, only 2 months. Yep. And so the volume of work is just phenomenal. So and it shows, you know, in terms of your really widespread knowledge about all of these issues, which are sort of your day-to-day work. In terms of our listeners, you know, any suggestions about how they can maybe follow along in the representation you provide for them to kind of keep abreast of what's the hot topics?
Yeah, I certainly encourage folks to go to my website and sign up for my newsletter. We mostly the newsletter, we largely just produce that during the legislative session. I do that shared with my colleague, Representative Emily Alvarado. In addition, you know, folks should always feel free to email me the things that are on their minds. I can tell you, I have a lot of emails from Vashon folks about the ferry system. And, you know, it is usually from a capacity standpoint, I can't guarantee that we will reply to every email, but I can guarantee you that we see every email and that we, you know, think about every email and respond to as many as we can.
Wonderful. All right. Well, let's do some closeout here. Just to set the stage for the next time I host the show, I will be asking the Brieflys and guests, what is Melania Trump thinking about? What will she insist upon adding to any of her future prenup agreements? So keep that in mind as we move through this next year of federal indictments. Our guest for the next edition of the Brown Briefly will be the new Beachcomber editor-in-chief, Alex Brewer. And so we'll look forward to hearing what Alex says as he captures the news on our island. Today, for Truman Bruce Craig and Representative Joe Fitzgibbon, I'm Kevin Jones. See you next week.
Bye now.